dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Regular listeners to this program are familiar with our ongoing series on the workings of the system of finance capital, The Wizards of Money with Smithy, where we have in the past learned that money is created out of thin air when private banks make loans to businesses and individuals. Though created out of thin air, it has very real impacts on people's lives and the ecosystem. The amount of money banks are allowed to create is determined by the Federal Reserve, which is actually a private bank regulated by the government. Why then doesn't the government insist that money be created to make a decent life available to all of its citizens? What does this have to do with so-called free trade? In the first hour of our program, we'll hear from someone who's examining these questions and how they are impacting his country. Paul Hellyer, the author of Goodbye, Canada. In the second hour of the program, Wizards of Money with Smithy returns with a dissection of hidden misdeeds and machinations in the casino of capitalism. What's most remarkable about Paul Hellyer, our first speaker this evening, is not what he's saying, but that a person such as himself is saying it. Hellyer has publicly stated that he's opposed to the rise of corporate rule. Hellyer is a mainstream politician who has previously held some of the most powerful positions in the Canadian government. He was Canada's youngest member of parliament when first elected in 1949, and the youngest cabinet minister when appointed to the government of Louis Saint-Laurent 8 years later. He served as deputy prime minister in the government of Pierre Trudeau, from which he resigned in 1969 when the government refused to accept the recommendations of a housing task force he chaired. Hellyer came out of political retirement in the late 1990s to found a new political party, the Canadian Action Party, whose central platform contains the following statement. Quote, "The Canadian Action Party is committed to the view that human dignity is the underlying principle of a democratic society, and that the purpose of political organization is to guarantee equal opportunity in order to give full expression to that dignity." Close quote. Hellyer is the author of a recent book, Goodbye, Canada. He spoke late last month at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, Ontario.
When I wrote Goodbye, Canada, it was my belief that Canada was headed toward annexation by the United States. I felt we had maybe 2 or 3 years before we passed the point of no return, after which annexation would become inevitable. And I don't say the flag will come down in 2 or 3 years, because it won't. It could be 5 or 10 or 15 or 20. But after 2 or 3 years, we will have gone so far that no one could practically turn it around and stop the process. So I decided that a wake-up call was needed. And I decided to write Goodbye, Canada, and the title was deliberately intended to get people's attention and to try and get them to pay attention and decide whether, in fact, they're interested in their country and want to keep it independent or not. Well, all of this was happening before the tragic events of September the 11th last year. And since then, the pace has quickened. The danger has become more imminent. And why has this happened to us? Well, there's been a latent trend toward continentalism since World War II, but it was never serious until 1988. And that was the year that the Free Trade Agreement was signed. We were misled. We were duped. We were led to believe that it was a trade agreement. That's what the papers said. That's what the electronic media said. That's what Mr. Mulroney said. Guaranteed access to U.S. markets. Well, that's what I thought, too, until I read it. And when I read it, I said, this isn't about trade at all. This is about investment. The Americans wanted access to our industries and our resources, especially our oil and gas, and very soon our water. And so they insisted in putting in that free trade agreement a clause called the National Treatment Clause, which 98% of Canadians have never heard of. And incidentally, I don't think most of the cabinet ministers in the cabinet at the time really knew what it was all about either. I have yet to meet a minister from the Mulroney government who had read the agreement before it was signed. And that includes John Crosby, who was a minister of trade at the time, who boasts in his memoirs that he hadn't read it. This national treatment clause was put in at the American insistence. And what it did was to give American investors the same rights in Canada as Canadian citizens. And I think this is wrong in principle. I mean, what's the advantage of citizenship if foreign investors have the same rights that you have? But what it did in practice was to give foreign investors the right to invest in Canada without conditions and without limits. So we can no longer say to them, well, you're welcome if you invest in Thunder Bay or Baie-Comeau or Powell River or Trois-Rivières. You're welcome if you hire Canadians. You're welcome if you export part of your product or if you leave the technology when you go upstate and go. No conditions. And secondly, no limits. So that we can't say to them, you can't own more than 50% of our forest industries because the treaty says they can own them all. We can't say that you can't buy more than 10% of the farms in Elgin County because the treaty says they can buy them all. Can't say that you can't own more than 80% or 50% or 70% of our oil and gas reserves because the treaty says they can buy them all. And that's exactly what they're in the process of doing at the present time. Since the free trade agreement was signed, 13,000 companies, Canadian companies, have been sold to foreigners, the majority to our cousins south of the border. And the pace is accelerating. We're losing 5 or 6 companies a day. And the dollar value and the size of the companies being sold is increasing. In the last year or two, McMillan Bloedel, one of the biggest forest industry companies, the icon of the forest industry really, was sold to Weyerhaeuser. And then, more recently, in the oil patch in Alberta, Anderson Explorations and West Coast Transmission and Canadian Hunter Explorations. And you know, it's interesting. They were so concerned about a national energy policy, but now what they're getting is an international energy policy where the benefits are going to flow south of the border because that's where ownership is going. And there are more to come. Mr. Manley, who is now our Deputy Prime Minister, and who, when he was Minister of Trade, did an interview with the National Post. He said that the foreign ownership restrictions are going to come off telecommunications, transportation, and, quote, even the banks. Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know what that means. It means that Shaw and Rogers will be sold to Americans. Eventually, Bell Telephone with CTB in tow, and Air Canada, and even the banks will be either controlled by or owned by organizations of the size of Citibank Group and First Boston and so on. If this keeps up for another 2 or 3 years, there will be nothing left of Canada but an empty shell. And two things happen. One, when the ownership goes, so do the best jobs, the top jobs, the decision-making jobs, the ones that the best and brightest aspire to. So as ownership goes and the best jobs go, that means that young Canadians who aspire to the top jobs would have to leave the country, because there wouldn't be those kinds of jobs here. Not only that, the tax base is eroded, because foreign-owned companies on average pay less tax than Canadian-owned companies. So in effect, we collect less tax, which means we have less capacity to finance healthcare and education and environmental concerns. And that means either a bigger burden on those of us who are still here, or we have to cut back our services, which we've been in the process of doing right across the board. Well, Canada is a victim of globalization. Globalization is leading to the colonization of all small countries and middle powers. And in Canada's case, first to colonization, and then because of our unique geographical position vis-a-vis the United States, to annexation. Well, who's behind globalization? Well, first of all, I'd like to say that globalization is not just one big ball of wax. When I think of globalization, I think of cholesterol. There's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. The good cholesterol is life-enhancing, and the bad cholesterol can kill you. The good globalization is technologically driven. So that includes things like the internet, opening up the world to a range of knowledge and understanding never before even thought possible. And that is good, provided you don't become addicted to it. The bad globalization is unrestricted investment, unrestricted foreign investment. And this part of globalization is agenda-driven. It's an attempt on the part of some of the richest, most powerful people in the world to re-engineer the world for their own private benefit. Now, there are three principal groups involved, and I'll just refer to them very briefly. I give a little bit more information about them in my book, Goodbye Canada, which I think you would find interesting. The first was the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and it is the oldest of the groups. And its relationship to the State Department in the United States is like that of a Siamese twin. More than 50 years ago, it was talking about an expanded empire, which included all of the former British Empire plus some additional Asian countries. That's more than 50 years ago. So they've been working at it assiduously ever since. Then the second group is the Bilderbergers. And this is a group of elite people who get their name from the Hotel de Bilderberg in Holland, where they held their first meeting in 1954. It was chaired by Prince Bernhard. They have met every year since, except one, when the prince was involved in an alleged scandal, a little bit of kickback or something other, and they canceled the meeting because they were afraid of some bad publicity. They have done some good things, as I also mentioned in the book, to be fair. But they have now gone on the side of the one world economy, the borderless world, because that is the world which would maximize their profits and their capital accumulation. And as I say, they include some of the richest, most powerful people in the whole world. The third is the Trilateral Commission. The Trilateral Commission was established by Zbigniew Brzezinski and Nelson Rockefeller in 1974. And incidentally, Nelson Rockefeller is a name that is involved in all of these groups. He has been in the Council on Foreign Relations all his life, I guess, and then the Bilderbergers, and then the Trilateral Commission. Brzezinski realized that Japan was coming up as a power and couldn't be ignored. So he wrote a paper about trilateralism. He and Rockefeller took it to the Bilderberg meeting in 1973, and it was favorably received, and that gave him the confidence to establish the Trilateral Commission in 1974. It has become so powerful that it has picked every president of the United States since Jimmy Carter. They pick them, finance them, get them elected, and then tell them, in effect, what to do. Well, there's one exception. They tried to get George Bush Sr. to follow Carter, but five of the coastal states in the United States ran full-page ads saying, Bush has been given to you by the same people who gave you Jimmy Carter, and that meant he couldn't get the primary, and so Reagan had to come in, and they took the Reagan-Bush ticket. Reagan was just as advantageous to them as Bush would have been, and then, of course, eventually Bush got his term. And it's interesting how this system works, and it really affects both the United States and Canada. Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, says the United States has two governments, the permanent and the provisional. The permanent government consists of the 500 Fortune companies, the most powerful and biggest 500 companies in the U.S. The largest law firms in Washington that do their legal work, the largest PR firms that do their public relations, and the top civil servants, both military and civil. And they constitute the permanent government of the United States. And then every few years they have, and here I paraphrase a bit, a charade called an election. And that's when the permanent government picks the actors to go on the stage to read the scripts written by the permanent government. And they try and pick actors who won't depart too much from the script, that they won't improvise too much. And so, you know, they have something like that in mind when they pick George Bush Jr. Subtle but pervasive power. They own all the news media, so they control what we hear and see. And this is the way they brought Carter up. He was an unknown peanut farmer, just somebody else who was interested in politics. And they decided that he'd make a good candidate for the presidency, or their candidate. So they got their media to start building him up and making him a household name. And pretty soon he was a serious candidate for the Democratic primary, and won it and became president. This same media group has been responsible for brainwashing us to believe that globalization is A, inevitable, and B, good. And I say it is neither. It is only inevitable if we let it happen, and it's only good for the 2 to 5% of the richest, most powerful people in the world. They have the most powerful propaganda machine in the history of the world. The brainwashing that they have done, I would say, has no equal since the 1930s and the Third Reich in Germany. Well, then who are the enforcers of globalization? Well, they're the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization. I call them the unholy trio. Some people think I'm being a bit harsh when I say that, but I don't really think so, because what they're really engaging is economic terrorism. That's what they're doing. Let me give you a little history of the IMF. It came out of the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944, New Hampshire. Its purpose was to lend money to countries from time to time when they ran short of foreign exchange, so they wouldn't have to change their exchange rates. In those days, we had fixed exchange rates. Well, eventually, that system broke down for the same reason that you saw recently in Argentina. And so then the IMF had no raison d'etre. But like a lot of these international institutions, once they're born, they've refused to die. They just kept going in the hope that some purpose would come along. Well, eventually it did. When Paul Volcker became chairman of the Federal Reserve System, he was a fan, a disciple of Milton Friedman and his colleagues at the University of Chicago, and he decided to put monetarism to the test. And so he tinkered around for a couple of years in the late 70s and then decided to go all out. And he brought on that terrible recession in 1981-82. Millions of people lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of businesses went bankrupt. Tens of thousands of farmers lost their farms after five or six generations in the family. Social chaos, but also economic chaos. They did succeed in putting the inflation genie partly, not totally, partly back in the bottle, which was the purpose of this whole thing, but they let the debt genie out of the bottle, and it's not back in yet. Well, what happened, of course? Volcker pushed interest rates to 18% in the United States. They went to 22% in Canada. I had been in the house building business in my younger years, and there were people in Toronto who had repurchased homes that we had sold originally for $13,000 or $14,000. And they had purchased for $100,000 or $125,000, who actually paid more interest in 1 year on their mortgage than the original price of the house. Well, what happened, of course, was that third world countries couldn't service their debt at 18%. They had just been getting by, say, 6%. But all of a sudden, 18 out of it. A little history there, too. The first president of the World Bank was concerned at the level of debt in third world countries. So he appointed a commission headed by my former boss, Lester Pearson, to look at third world debt. And Pearson reported that, yes, third world debt was so high, it was about up to the eyeballs, that it wouldn't be long if it continued before they would pay all of their foreign exchange earnings just to service the interest on their debt. Well, that was before the crisis of 81-82. And so when they couldn't pay the interest on the debt, they were, in effect, about ready to default. Volcker realized he was about to collapse the whole Western system. So he got the New York banks in a room, because they were all technically bankrupt. And he said, you're going to have to lend these countries more money to pay the interest on what they owe until I can get the IMF to ride to the rescue. Which he ultimately did. And the IMF rode to the rescue with our money. And this allowed the international bankers to get their money out and our money in. Well, it worked so well that they used the same system again with the Mexican peso crisis. Again, the international financial community got their money out. The Mexican people are stuck with the cost of the bank defaults. And then they used it in Southeast Asia. Southeast Asian countries have been doing beautifully, thank you. And some of the investors in New York and elsewhere said, hey, we want part of that action. So the U.S. twisted the arms of the countries down there and said, you've got to allow foreign investment whether you want it or not. So a lot of hot money went in, and then one or two of the currencies, the baht in particular, was overvalued. So it was just like being in a theater when somebody yells fire. And people started pulling their money out. Crisis develops, IMF to the rescue with our money. But not to rescue the countries, which had terrible recessions after that, high unemployment, high prices, but to rescue the international banks and, in effect, to cause chaos with the people of those countries. But it got to the point where both the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which had to be called the rescue in that case because they ran out of money, were imposing conditions, largely at the instigation of the U.S. Treasury Department. And so they told all of these countries, we're going to bail you out, but there is a price attached. And that price includes opening your borders to imports, whether you can afford them or not, privatizing your industries, removing subsidies on basic foods. You have to grow food for export to pay, earn money to pay for the interest on your debt instead of growing food to keep your own people alive. You have to allow foreigners to buy your assets and your industries. And most ironic of all, you have to agree not to use your central banks to help finance your essential public services like healthcare and education. Well, why was this ironic? It was ironic because this was the issue on which the U.S. War for Independence was fought. We were told it was tea and taxes. But Benjamin Franklin, in his memoirs, makes it very clear that the issue was the right of the colonies to print their own money. They have been doing this very successfully. And even Adam Smith was impressed with how well their system was working. He was not a fan of government-created money, but he admitted that the system was working beautifully. And so the London banks found out about this, and they said, hey, look at this huge market for loans that we're not getting in on. And so they got the British Parliament to pass a law prohibiting the colonies from printing their own money. Instead, they had to borrow from British banks and repay principal and interest in gold, which they didn't have. So a terrible depression followed in the U.S., or what was then the British colonies. And so they issued another batch of money, and war became inevitable. Now, the five major countries led by the United States are doing that to every country in the world, one at a time. And so it won't come as a surprise to you that many countries around the world detest the U.S. as much as the American colonies did England in the 18th century, simply because they've had so many of their rights and privileges taken away. Well, the result of all of this is the end of democracy as we have known it, and the substitution of a plutocracy. Rule really by unelected, unaccountable officials, international bureaucrats. I'd like to give you a few examples. First of all, under NAFTA Chapter 11. Again, most people have never heard of NAFTA's Chapter 11. When I raise it, they'll think it's the U.S. Bankruptcy Protection Chapter 11, which is something entirely different. But this is a clause in NAFTA which gives foreign investors greater rights in Canada than Canadian citizens. And they are allowed, if any level of our government, federal, provincial, or municipal, passes a law or amends a law or a regulation that affects their profits, their future profits, or their potential profits, they have the right to sue our government. They do. In the first case, which some of you may have heard of, was the Ethel case. And the Parliament of Canada passed a law prohibiting the importation into Canada or the distribution within Canada of MMT, which is a manganese-based gasoline additive. The Ethel Corporation sued. And when our lawyers told us we might lose the case, we settled for $13 million U.S., about 19 or 20 million Canadian, which we, the taxpayers, had the privilege of paying. But worse than that, Parliament had to repeal the law. And what kind of a democracy is it when a foreign corporation can tell the Parliament of Canada what laws it can pass and what laws it can't pass? And almost as bad, two ministers of the Crown, two cabinet ministers, had to stand in their places and read statements to the effect that MMT was not harmful to either the environment or the health at the very moment when the latest scientific evidence was indicating that it was indeed harmful to the health, especially of children. Well, there are other suits that we have settled and some pending, two that are pending that would interest you. United Parcel Services, UPS, is suing the Government of Canada for $225 million because it says Canada Post is subsidizing the courier service unfairly. And Sunbelt Water Corporation of California is suing us for between $1.5 and $10.5 billion U.S. because we won't let them sell our water. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, really, the way the world is working. The decisions under NAFTA Chapter 11 are made by three-person panels, meet in secret, not under press scrutiny, not abiding by the rules of evidence, and whose decisions are not appealable through the court system. In other words, a total abrogation of democracy, as we have known it. And the World Trade Organization is operating similarly. Decisions by three-person panels, not rules of evidence, not subject to press scrutiny, and not subject to appeal through the courts. They have already turned down three of our laws. We had a law which penalized the people in Canada who advertised in U.S. split-run magazines. Time Warner, as it was then, said to the U.S. government, hey, we want more of the Canadian advertising revenue, so sick them, go get them. So they went to the WTO, and a panel that wouldn't know the difference between Maclean's and Time ruled against us. And we had to repeal our law. If the shoe had been on the other foot, the Americans would not have put up with it for 1 minute. It is one of the worst cases of dumping you can think of, because the Time edition in the United States, it pays for all the editorial content, everything's paid for, and by U.S. advertising, and then they just take the same editorial content, sometimes they put in one-page Canadian, sometimes they don't, and bring it up here, free cost, zero cost approximately, and sell advertising at rates which no Canadian magazine could possibly compete with. And so what they wanted was to have other magazines do the same. And the net cost is going to be $125 to $150 million a year for us to pay if we want to subsidize and keep alive any kind of a magazine industry in this country at all. Really an atrocity. Then they ruled against us. They said the auto pack was illegal. The auto pack, as you would read in my book, is one of the only reasons that the trade figures have been looking good these last few years. The export of autos and parts, and they're counted double when they go down, parts go down to the States and come back as finished automobiles, or come up from the States and go back as finished automobiles. And that was protectionism. The auto pack was protectionism. And without it, the figures for trade would not have been nearly as good as they appear to be on the surface. And then they said we would have to change our patent law to correspond with U.S. patent law. And that means that we have to pay more for our drugs, millions more for our drugs, at a time when our healthcare system is already in crisis due to inadequate funding. And all of these decisions made by panels, overturning our laws, even though they're just bureaucrats, unelected, unaccountable, and not subject to the rule of law. Well, all of this was before September the 11th, 2001. And since then, at U.S. insistence, both the U.S. and Canada have been turned into police states. And the people who feel this most are people who have come here from Eastern Europe and understand what it's like to live in a country where a police can show up in the middle of the night and you never know what is going to happen. Rights and freedoms that took generations to establish were snuffed out overnight. And Canada, at U.S. insistence, is spending $7 billion over 5 years to beef up our security. But it isn't really our security which is at stake, because we are not the target of terrorists. We have no reason to be. The $7 million tax is really for their benefit, and it's a kind of tax that we have to pay for some degree of cooperation in trade. And now they're proposing a continental defense system. And the origin of this was on September the 11th, they found that the Army, Navy, and Air Force didn't know what each other was doing, and so they decided to put them under a single command. And then they decided that was such a good thing that they'd like to put the Canadian Army and Navy under that same command. No reason for it whatsoever. Furthermore, they don't even say that they'll limit it to continental defense. to say that the troops could be used anywhere. And I don't know what that means. Could we wind up in another Vietnam as a result? I just don't want to take the chance. And the Minister of National Defense, Mr. Eggleton, who has been having his own problems recently, has said that we would not lose 1 ounce of sovereignty by putting our troops under U.S. command. In my opinion, it would be the biggest loss of sovereignty that we have undergone since we gained our independence from Great Britain. At the same time, people on both sides of the border are urging that we adopt the U.S. dollar. And if you watch the papers, the TV now, you can see the propaganda at work. But the people that want this to happen are pushing in that direction. And I'm not the least bit sure that they aren't manipulating the money markets as well. This would be even more dangerous, and it would be irreversible. We are just escaping the 45th recession or depression in the last 200 years. And not one of them really necessary, in my opinion. John Kenneth Galbraith, one of his many famous statements was that if you lay all the world's economists end to end, that they wouldn't reach a conclusion. I don't want to be too hard on them, but yes, I do. It's a dismal science. They've had 200 years to get a solution, and they haven't got it yet. And frankly, I think that's pretty poor. All of these recessions and depressions have been monetary phenomena. Simply stated, there's been a shortage of purchasing power, or as the economists call it, inadequate aggregate demand to keep the system running. You have to ask yourself, you know, I use an analogy in one or two books of a car that normally cruises down the highway at, say, 110 kilometers an hour, no, you know, just beautifully, smoothly, and all of a sudden slows down to 80. It won't go any faster no matter what you do. You take it into the garage, and the mechanic says, oh, it's cyclical. You know, give me a break. It's the same car. We have as many machines as we had last year, and as many people willing to work, maybe more, and you don't have to slow the thing down. And this is all due to the banking system and the way money is created. Most people I talk to have no idea where money comes from. My sister, even a year or so ago, said, well, surely it's gold-backed or something or other. No. 5% of it is printed by the government through the Bank of Canada. And that looks like this. 95% of it is printed by the private banks. When I say printed, you can say manufactured or created. It's all the same thing. Graham Towers, the first and brightest of the governors of the Bank of Canada, said banks manufacture money the way steel companies manufacture steel. That is their business. 5% of our money is legal tender. 95% is bank-created virtual money or credit money. And again, Galbraith says the means by which the banks do it is so simple that it offends the intelligence, which is the reason a lot of people can't believe it. But what happens if you go into a bank and you want to borrow $30,000 to buy a car? They'll ask you for collateral. Give them stocks, bonds, second mortgage on your house. If you haven't got that, a co-signature from a rich mother-in-law or uncle or someone. They're satisfied with the collateral. They give you a note to sign, which you guarantee to pay back the principal with interest at, say, prime plus 1.5% or 2.5%, depending on the color of your eyes. They tap the computer, and presto, $30,000 appears in your account. And seconds earlier, that money did not exist. Now, part of the mythology is that they lend you today what I deposited yesterday. Not true. They lend you today what they create out of thin air today. And the problem is that all bank money is created as debt, which has to be repaid. But that isn't the end of it. It's money that has to be repaid with interest. And so if no one creates any money with which to pay the interest, what do you have to do? Well, the answer is you have to borrow more in order to pay the interest on what you already owe and go deeper and deeper into debt. And so when you look around the world, you know, it doesn't matter. Pick your country, Germany, France, United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, and you see these huge federal debts in all of these countries. It is not primarily due to profligate spending on the part of successive generations of politicians. Even though I have to admit there's some taxpayers' money is squandered from time to time. Don't deny it. But primarily, it's the way money is created as debt. And that is the reason that this fantastic debt overlies the whole monetary system worldwide. We let the banks blow up the virtual money like a balloon until the level of debt gets so big that it's unsustainable. And then it's like a balloon with a pin stuck in it, just goes, and you have a recession or a depression. And then the whole thing starts all over again. In the meantime, of course, a lot of people get wiped out. And a lot of innocent people were just starting businesses, and the banks call their loans and put them out of business before they have a chance to really get established. Well, we must have some interest-free money or debt-free money to make the system work. I'm going to speak for just a minute or two based on my experience a long time ago. I'm a child of the Depression. And in 1938, there were no jobs in Canada. None. Then the war came along. All of a sudden, everyone was working, either in the armed forces, in factories, making munitions, doing things. And you might ask, how was this possible financially? Where did they get the money? Well, it was very simple. The Bank of Canada printed it, and they bought government bonds with it. And then the government paid the Bank of Canada interest on those bonds. And the Bank of Canada gave it back as dividends, so that the net cost was just above zero, just the cost of administration. And this was the system that we had between 1937, 1939, and 1974. It was a system that got us out of the Great Depression, that helped finance the war, that helped finance the post-war infrastructure like the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Highway, the great airports that we built, and lay the foundation for our Social Security system. In 1974, we changed the system. When I say we, I really mean the central banks of the First World. They adopted the ideas of Milton Friedman and his colleagues at the University of Chicago, and it's been downhill ever since. And one of the things that they did was to give back to the private banks their virtual monopoly to create money, which had been the pre-depression system, the boom-bust system. And, of course, the Bank of Canada stopped buying its share of bonds. And that's when we got into hot with foreigners, the Japanese and the Germans and the Americans. And You can see the difference. In 1974, the Bank of Canada owned 20% of federal government debt, which was the same as an interest-free loan. Today, they all own about 4% or 5% federal government debt. And so what we have to do, if we want to be a northern tiger, a number of things, and one of them is to go back to the economic system that we had between 39 and 74. Northern Tiger, colony, or 51st state, that is really the choice. And the choice is ours. And if we want to be the Northern Tiger, or even the respected middle power that we used to be, we have to abrogate NAFTA and other trade agreements that have the National Treatment Clause in them and negotiate genuine trade agreements that are really about trade and not about investment. You know, even Peter Lougheed, who was one of the great promoters of the Free Trade Agreement, admitted on Pamela Wallen's show a year and a half ago that we might have to go back to the Foreign Investment Review Agency complete about turn, because he can see what's happening, that we're losing our country. And then we have to say no to the customs union, which is being proposed by some of our businessmen and others, because that means really adopting U.S. laws. And in recent years, for example, we would not have been able to trade with Cuba or to travel there if we had had a customs union. And we have to say no to the America's command and build up our own armed forces and spend the money instead to buy helicopters that are safe to fly. The helicopters on the ships that are in the Persian Gulf at the present time were bought on my watch. They're worn out 10 or 15 years ago. They're not safe to fly. They're almost impossible to maintain. And it is, you know, it's a tragedy bordering on criminality to have helicopters that old and decrepit in frontline service. And then this time we have to get help and transport to take our troops over there. In 1967, I had the armed forces do a study which showed that we could have moved at that time more than twice as many people as we're sending over now, and all of their equipment, all with our own transport, and have brought in 30 planes to support them at the same time, all in 14 days. Well, you compare that to our capability today, and you can just get some feeling for what we could be spending the money on. And then we have to keep our monetary sovereignty and use the Bank of Canada intelligently. In my two most recent books, Stop, Think, and Goodbye Canada, I have proposed that we split the money creation function 50-50 between the government of Canada through the Bank of Canada and the private banks. If we did that, that would give the government of Canada about $15 billion a year in additional revenue. And that is enough to meet all of the needs of the health services, education, the environment, the arts, the armed forces, municipal infrastructure, and all of the things that we really need to do to make this country great again. And still enough left over to bring down taxes, eliminate the GST over 3 years, and reduce the federal debt at a modest rate over a period of time. And that is what is possible. And, you know, people often say, well, will it work? And it reminds me of the story of the two nuns. They were driving from Kenora to Thunder Bay, and they ran out of gas. Fortunately, they'd seen a gas station back about a quarter of a mile, and they decided they'd walk back and get some. And problem was, the only thing they had to put it in was a bedpan. So they took the bedpan and went back to the gas station, filled it up, walked back to the car and started to pour the gasoline out of the bedpan into the gas tank. A stockbroker in a great big Cadillac was driving by at the time with his partner. And they saw what was happening, rolled the window down, and said, "If it works, we'll convert." Well, all I can say, it worked before, 1939, 1974, gave us the best 25 years of the 20th century, and it would work again. And if we do these things, we can escape from our present colonial status and become a proud, independent, and prosperous country again. The postscript of my book is entitled, Let's Save Canada and Do the World and Ourselves a Favor. And there I cite a number of reasons why I think we should remain independent. When comparing the two countries and its peoples, I say, in conclusion, we are not better than the Americans, we are not worse than the Americans, but we are different, and vive la différence. Because there are people that like both lifestyles. I get emails almost every day from Americans who have moved up here. And one chap the other day said, can I sue the Canadian government? Because I thought I was moving to a foreign country when I came to Canada 30 years ago. And you may have seen, well, the Toronto Star, you won't get out here, but an article by a former deputy minister in the Ontario government saying that he feared that he was going to wind up in his own country again without ever having moved. And so there are people that prefer it. And Canadians would like to go the other way because there's more hustle and bustle. down south of the border. But if we keep the two countries independent, then people can choose. You get the maximum freedom of choice, which I think is important. But the U.S. and the world need an independent Canada to advise the U.S. candidly. They simply cannot achieve a secure world by military means. It is impossible. You can't bomb hate out of people. It won't work. As a matter of fact, you are more likely to increase the level of hate if you start bombing people willy-nilly all over the world. And in my book, I quote President Bush from his inaugural address, where he said, "We will build our defenses beyond challenge, lest weakness invite challenge." And in this chapter 11 called Mr. President, he said, "Mr. President, those are brave words, but you can't fulfill that promise because we don't live in that kind of a world. The only secure world is a happy and just world. And to achieve this, the U.S. has to change its foreign policy in Central Asia and in the Gulf area. It has to change its economic policy and stop ramming the Washington consensus down the throats of countries everywhere, in effect telling them how to run their affairs and taking away their right to run their own affairs in their own way, which means allowing limitations on direct foreign investment. They have to give the world a chance. And at the same time, they have to launch a 10-year war against ill health and poverty on a global basis. 34,000 people a day are dying around the world due to malnutrition and ill health. 34,000 every day of the year. Now, the irony is that we have the wealth and the know-how to do something about that. But instead, our priorities are Star Wars and putting weapons in space. And it doesn't make any sense if the object of the exercise is a secure world. And presumably, that is the object of the exercise. Well, these things we have to do. We have to, in my opinion, pay off the third world debt. And in the last two books, I have told how that could be done with no expense to the taxpayers. And if we do these things, there'll be no utopia. I'm not a utopian. I don't think you're ever going to have a perfect world because there will never be perfect people. But it would be a reasonably secure world if special interests weren't really trying to push everyone around in a way that is unsatisfactory to them. Well, Canadians won't take to the streets to regain our independence, but we don't have to. Our war for independence can be achieved through political action. And we now have a one-party system. And we have three options. The status quo. One columnist in the Toronto Star said, well, we just have to accept the fact that the Liberals are permanent government. Learn to live with it. And let the premiers do the opposition and the press. Well, the press have no opposition that I can see, and certainly there's very little politically. Then the second option is to unite the right. And at the moment, the people behind globalization are trying to do just that. The Bay Street Boys are all in there doing their best to get the right united so that if the government should change, that nothing else will happen. There will be no real change. And I said to someone earlier today, it used to make me very, very angry when people would say to me it didn't matter whether you voted for the Liberals or Conservatives because it didn't make any difference. And the reason I got angry was because I knew there was a lot of truth in it. And there's not much point in just having two alternatives where the only difference is going to be the difference in the people with their fingers in the cookie jar. We want a real alternative. We want, and this is the reason that I have been promoting a third option, which is a big progressive, new progressive, pro-Canada party, which is not in the pockets of Bay Street and the globalizers, so that when the next election comes, the people of Canada would be given the choice. Do you want to remain independent, or do you want to become a Fitch First State? Because unless you have that kind of a party to give the Canadian people a choice, it's going to happen by default, without us ever having given our advice or consent. And that is not my kind of democracy. So I think that this is the only hope for Canada. And really, because we would be lighting a beacon for the world, the only hope for the world. Thank you very much.
That was Canadian author and Canadian Action Party leader Paul Hellyer speaking late last month in Thunder Bay, Ontario. In the fairy tale of the Emperor's New Clothes, it's a child who states the obvious, while the great and powerful lie and cover their behinds, followed by the rest of the adult population. Charlotte Aldebaran, a sixth grader from Presque Isle, Maine, penned the following essay for her English class. She wrote, "The American flag stands for the fact that cloth can be very important. It is against the law to let the flag touch the ground or leave the flag flying when the weather is bad. The flag has to be treated with respect. You can tell just how important this cloth is because when you compare it to people, it gets much better treatment. Nobody cares if a homeless person touches the ground. A homeless person can lie all over the ground all night long without anyone picking him up, folding him neatly, and sheltering him from the rain. School children have to pledge loyalty to this piece of cloth every morning. No one has to pledge loyalty to justice and equality and human decency. No one has to promise that people will get a fair wage or enough food to eat, or affordable medicine, or clean water, or air free of harmful chemicals. But we all have to promise to love a rectangle of red, white, and blue cloth." Betsy Ross would be quite surprised to see how successful her creation has become. Thomas Jefferson would be disappointed to see how little of the flag's real meaning remains. And that was an essay by Charlotte Aldebaran, a sixth grade student in Presque Isle, Maine. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. The Wizards of Money with Smithy is up next.